All right, this is Pure Decking for March the 22nd, 1343. This is the show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps, and tonight we have RU46, Fox, Syntax, Analog, and Sard. What's up, guys?
Soap.
Yo.
I just realized the Galaxy 15 Skype account's not online, so I'm going to fix that real quick. And just to go ahead and throw it out there, has anybody else seen the new design Patient Zero did on the website?
Yeah, it looks good. Looks
it does. There's I was wondering who did it.
Dead air.
Yeah. It's a nice looking theme. He did us a new logo and everything up there. So thank you very much, Tack, for brand new look on the site. So
that is actually really pretty,
isn't it?
Yeah. Sweet.
Yep. So, anyways, the Skype on the broadcast box is now apparently popping up advertising.
Yeah. Thank you, Microsoft. I enjoy your dick in my ass.
Yeah, get bent. Anyways.
You just enjoy dick in your ass.
I will not dignify that with a response.
That's the wrong crickets. No. I've got the wrong crickets on the soundboard. I got to fix that. And we're off to a rousing start tonight. Tell you what. There you go. Is this right?
Arousing.
Arousing?
There
arousing
it is.
My other.
Rousing as in fail.
I thought you sounded like you said arousing.
I know. So that's what I thought.
That's just what's on your all's minds.
Okay. Look at my show. What do you think's on my mind most of the time?
As little as possible.
I am looking at Minecraft. I am a little aroused.
All right. First story I've got up is from Wired. This is just awesome. Hollywood studios want a federal judge to preserve data on the 66.6 million users of Mega Upload, the file sharing service that was shuttered in January due to federal indictments targeting its operators. The Motion Picture Association of America is requesting Carpathia, Mega Upload's Virginia-based server host, to retain the 25 petabytes of Mega Upload data on its servers, which includes account information for Mega Upload's millions of users. That's according to a newly surfaced court filing in the Mega Upload prosecution in connection to the charges of racketeering and criminal copyright infringement. The MPAA said it wanted to have the data because it might sue Mega Upload and others for contributing to copyright infringement. In other words, you know the joke we've been making about if you uploaded anything to Mega Upload, they know? It's probably not a joke.
Well, someone associated with Mega Upload or the file sharing company needs to go to any of the big box home improvement stores and buy a maul. Now, a maul is a 10-pound sledgehammer on one side.
Oh.
Okay. On the other side is an axe.
Nope. It's actually much simpler to that because that's destruction of evidence. Instead, it's like, oh, yeah, well, you seized all their assets, so they quit paying their hosting bills. So we've already reappropriated all those servers and drives for other hosting companies. Yeah, Facebook bought them all up. Sorry. So. Not only that, it's legal.
Or we just went off, a tactical nuclear missile, like, not on top of the servers, because, like you said, that would be destruction of evidence, but we just do it near it so the EMP blows it out.
Wait a minute. Sard, are you suggesting we nuke Virginia? Because I'm totally for this. I just wanted to make sure that that's what you were actually suggesting.
That depends. Is anyone from the government listening?
Dude, if you ain't on a watch list already, you will be.
Well, like we used to do in IHN, I would like to welcome all of the Alphabet boys to the show tonight, and
Alphabet
thank you for listening.
We all enjoy.
Actually, speaking of the Mega Upload case, I don't have it, but I saw earlier in the week where a federal judge had decided that the court seizure of a lot of their assets was actually illegal, so or not warranted, I think was the term they used, but that means illegal.
Let's face it, this is gonna go on for years.
Yeah, it is. And just to keep things going, this Sard actually sent me this, but I've seen it in a few places, so we'll use the one Sard sent me. Innocent Mega Upload users, it's on Packet Storm Security. Innocent Mega Upload users who are already locked out of their accounts are now being targeted with fake legal shakedown letters. See, the actual story was the first one, saying the courts ask, or they're trying to get the court to tell the servers to keep this data. Now you've got fake legal shakedown letters claiming that they've already used it. The letters appear to come from a law firm, says Torrent Freak, that claims to be acting on behalf of movie and music firms Sony, EMI, Universal, and Paramount, acting on... that line's messed up. And offers recipients a no-good, must-miss opportunity to settle out of court. We have seen these shakedowns before, and they have had more legitimacy. If you could say that, at least they did in the case of ACS Law come from an actual law firm. In this case, they do not. A fake law firm called Dr. Croner and Colligan is behind the letters, and as far as we can work out, does not have a website. A Google search just returns a lot of results with the word fake attached. The letters could scare some people who think they might have downloaded copy-protected material, so of course we recommend you keep an eye out for them. Clues are in the missives, and Torrent Freak said that they do not include the sort of things you would expect to see in such letters. They're using fake IPs and timestamps, they do not mention any titles of allegedly misreported media content, and they ask that payments be sent to Slovakia.
Slovakia, yeah.
So, here's a hint. If EMI or Universal or Sony is asking you to pay their law firm in Slovakia, it's probably not real.
No, wait. No, it is. Just pay them.
Yeah, that's...
Just pay them, man.
Yeah, sure. So. But yeah, the scammers are already out on the Mega Upload shutdown. Like, yeah, we saw you had a Mega Upload account, so you're going to have to pay us because we know you were uploading shit. I just wonder how many random people, like, who's like never heard of Mega Upload are getting these letters and be like, what?
Because, you know, I don't have a fake email host in Slovakia or a fake, you know, bank account there either. So pay.
Damn it, Syntax. Are you scamming people again?
Or if another way, you can just route it through my PayPal account and I'll make sure it's not a scam. Yeah. That way, if it is a scam, I'll give you your money back. Trust me.
Yeah, that'll work.
Internet.
That'll work. So, all right. This next one is from Delimiter. This is actually in Australia, so we'll be expecting expert witness from our key resident anarchist Australian. So, the federal government of Australia has declined to reveal almost any information about a second secret industry meeting held in February this year to address the issue of internet piracy, using a variety of complex justifications to avoid releasing virtually any detail of the meeting under freedom of information laws. The closed-door meeting, held on 8th of February, saw major Australian ISPs sit down with the representatives of the film, television, and music industries and the Federal Attorney General's Department with the aim of discussing a potential industry resolution to the issue of online copyright infringement. The meeting is the fourth such meeting to be held after a series of other meetings were held late last year under similar circumstances. The Attorney General's Department acknowledged in early February that another anti-piracy meeting had taken place. As we did with the first meeting in September, Delimiter subsequently filed a wide-ranging request for information about the meeting to be released under Freedom of Information laws, seeking details such as the list of attendees, notes taken by any government staff, a copy of documentation issued to attendees, email correspondence, their firstborn, blood sample, and conduct of the meeting, and internal department correspondence regarding it. Late last week, the Attorney General's Department responded that the Freedom of Information request providing a series of five documents. However, using a variety of justifications, the department has redacted almost all of the information previously contained in the documents, including 14 pages of notes taken by a departmental staffer at the event and four other pages of notes taken by a senior staffer from the Communications Minister Stephen Conroy's department. I'm guessing they handed them the Sharpie pages. I mean, just everything Sharpied. According to the documents, which are available full here, they've got them on the site there. You can follow the link in the show notes if you're interested in it. The following organizations were invited to the February meeting: the Digital Entertainment Alliance of Australia, the Australian Content Industry Group, the Communications Alliance, Telestra, IINet, and the Department of Broadband Communications at the Digital Economy, and represented by Assistant Secretary Richard Winder. So apparently Australia's government is having secret meetings to decide their laws as opposed to, you know, holding their meetings in public, because nobody cares when they do that either.
I tell you, man, whenever that twisted, crippled motherfucker Stephen Conroy is involved in it, you know some dodgy shit's going on.
Well,
that's
I
all I have to say about that.
I imagine they're probably trying to pass something similar to Sopa Pippa, and they just don't want anybody to know about it because they don't want the massive backlash that they saw in the States when they tried to pass that law.
Yeah, it's just, dude, I have no idea anymore.
So now they're just going to pass it in secret and then start enforcing it.
Well, our freedom. Well, it was a couple of years ago. They decided to charge for the freedom of information. So if I go and request information on a government meeting, they're going to charge me money. So I can't just have it because, well, they're an open government. They're actually going to charge me money.
Well, is it a reasonable fee for, you know?
No. The more sensitive the material, the more it's going to cost you. One news agency asked for the documentation on how much a minister had spent on overseas holidays. It ended up costing around $128,000 to get the information.
Wow.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's called a deterrent.
Yeah, pretty much. I could be wrong on the how much it actually cost, but I know it was in the hundreds of thousands because that was what the story was led with. This cost us nearly as much as the minister cost to go overseas to let you know what happened.
That's messed up.
Yeah, dude, I have no idea. And we got elections this weekend for state, and I've literally have no idea. We are so far in the hole of money, like they owe billions and billions of dollars from a state that literally has so many mines in it that China is coming over here and asking, would you like to join part of their country?
Oh, God.
How do you go broke when you're earning that much revenue? I have no idea.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
There's all some twisted, devious shit going on in our governments right now. I want nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
That's what I was wondering about this, too. They said they redacted all this information on. I want to know, like, what terms, what allows them to redact all this information? I mean, if this is
national security.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, dude. There's no national security if they're meeting with people from, you know,
copyright
the Australian
groups, yeah.
RIAA. Yeah, exactly. How can they redact all that information, not be forced to prove it? Like I said, there's no national security shit in there.
Well, I mean, that's the hard part. Prove there isn't. It's like, how do you prove
it? We're not going to tell you because you just can't look in there.
I guess. That's fucked up.
Well, what are you going to do? I mean, it's gotten so crazy now, all you can do is vote them out and hope that the next batch you get's any better, which is not very likely.
Yeah,
but see, attempting to vote someone out when basically they're using, you know, falsified voter IDs and electronic voting machines is very hard.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, hell, go ahead.
They all know who each other are. They all drink after work with each other. The oppositions and the people in power are all friends. At the end of the day, they're all going to look after each other's interests when it comes to jobs. And if you ever see one get voted out, man, does he get a golden parachute and land feet first into a multi-million dollar banking job, or he gets, well, brought back into the fold as a consultant for the government.
Yep, that's about the only appropriate response I've got.
Yeah. I mean, I'm over it, to be honest, dude. That's why I just do the I Have Nothing show now, make it crazy and stupid, because this shit depresses the hell out of me.
Yeah, well, it's like we were discussing earlier, IHN should be the crazy, wacky stories, and Pure Decking is the good and depressing stories. Mm. Yeah. Okay, next story. This one's from IndieSpectrum.com. In Seattle, when Justin Bassett interviewed for a new job, he expected the usual questions about experience and references. He was also astonished when the interviewer asked for his Facebook username and password. Bassett, a New York City statistician, had just finished answering a few character questions when the interviewer turned on her computer to search for his Facebook page, but she couldn't see his private profile, so she turned back and asked him to hand over his login information. Bassett refused and withdrew his application, saying he didn't want to work for a company that would seek such personal information. But as the job market steadily improves, other job candidates are confronting the same question from prospective employers, and some of them cannot afford to say no. In their efforts to vet applicants, some companies and government agencies are going beyond merely glancing at a person's social networking profiles, instead asking to log in as the user to look around. It's akin to requiring somebody's house keys, said Kevin Orr, a George Washington University law professor and former federal prosecutor, who calls it an egregious privacy violation. Questions have been raised about the legality of the practice, which also, yeah, it's pretty fucking egregious. It's like, give us your passwords. legality, which is also the focus of proposed legislation in Illinois and Maryland that would forbid public agencies from asking for access to social networks. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, more on the story here. Yeah, companies that don't ask for passwords have taken other steps, such as asking applicants to friend human resource managers or to log into a company computer during the interview. Once employed, some workers have been required to sign non-disparagement agreements that ban them from talking negatively about an employer on social media. Well, that's not all that strange. So,
yeah, I've seen that happen a lot. When I was consulting, that was actually a very common thing, was to do an anti-disparagy clause, because it was like, they're like, okay, we know we suck, but you can't tell anyone how badly we suck.
Yeah. Usually those go both ways, though. And that's why when somebody calls up for a job reference, all they can say is, yes, they worked here. You know, because you can sue them for slander otherwise, or so it's getting to the point now where everything's so damn litigious you can't even be honest about a company. This is why I've said for many, many years, lie on Facebook. If you're going to have a Facebook profile, you know, set it up under your real name, friend a couple of friends who don't post crazy shit on Facebook, and your immediate family. Because they're not, well, depending on your immediate family. And only post...
You wouldn't want to have my immediate family.
Well, fair enough. But what you want to do is you want to think of the Facebook profile as the extension of the resume, right? You want to make sure everything on there is sparkly clean. You only have, you know, a handful of photos showing tasteful things, not any drunken parties, none of that crap. And then you set up a pseudonym, and that's where you put all the crazy shit. Or you just don't use Facebook. But, so that's actually what my Facebook is. It's totally, like, hardly ever use it. Blank, only family and a few handful of people on there. And the only people on there, you generally are people I work with. So it's very, very clean, if you will.
And that's the job I'm going to do after I'm finished dirt wrangling, man. I'm going to go into human resources and be the guy that hunts you down on the internet for employers. I'm going to do that as
bounty. Good money in that, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm just doing the training now. Like, thanks, Morph, for training me. But, working my skills up, set up to that, and way you go, man. I'm going to start my own HR company or something like that. I don't know.
Bringing more evil into the world one person at a time.
Dude. Where does the line stop, though? There's got to be a separation of work and your personal life. Like they said in the story, dude, it's like handing them the keys to your house, saying, okay, we'll hire you, but we need to go look at your house first. Well, let's say you didn't get there in time, so you left your big black dildo out on your dresser. So they come in, look around, like, oh, you have big black dildo on your dresser. And now, because of that, we aren't going to hire you because you're some weird freak.
Sard, why do you have a big black dildo?
It's not black, it's purple.
Dude, but that's... All right.
But it's my choice to have a goddamn purple dildo.
Yeah, but I don't want to employ you because you have a big purple dildo. So what that means is you got to start being as crafty as a motherfucker, and when you go to work, you hide all your shit.
Well, how long is it going to be before they go, okay, walk through the x-ray scanner. You know, we bought them surplus from the airports.
Man, there's no point being afraid of it. Just embrace it and learn how to circumvent it. And then once you figure out how to do that, share the knowledge with others, man.
Like you know, I said, you know, have a resume Facebook profile. You know, everything on there is perfect. You are the perfect candidate. Everything's squeaky clean. You know, there's nothing on there, you know, controversial or strange. If you use if you use applications to track your exercise, let those post, that kind of shit.
Yeah, what sounds more suspicious? You know, they're going, so what's your Facebook? You're going, I don't have one. Or going, oh no, look here. And they're like, oh my God, you are a model citizen.
It's like, yeah, I don't really do that much with it, but here you go.
Exactly.
Also, good idea. Change your Facebook passwords right before going to job interviews.
Yeah, that way, to 1234.
You know, something you can hand out, and then, you know, as soon as you get out, change it again. So.
Or, you know, a very horrible, nasty word in another language.
Like, I'd tell you my Facebook password, but I'm actually not allowed to under, you know, defamation laws. So
exactly.
I had to think on that one there for a bit. So, wow, we are blowing right through these a little bit quicker than I intended to. Oh, well, shit happens. So, last story I've got for tonight. This one's from Torrent Freak, and this one's fun. Miami judge Mark Schumacher has issued a landmark order in which he protects accused BitTorrent downloaders from mass lawsuits filed by copyright holders. One of the main arguments of the judge is that these were phishing expeditions and violate BitTorrent users' right to anonymous speech, which is protected by the Constitution, in order to effectively kill BitTorrent lawsuits in Florida state court. Every first-year law student knows that copyright-related course cases are exclusively a matter of federal law. You can't bring a copyright suit in state court, period. However, starting last year, more and more BitTorrent-related cases were filed at Florida state courts. The copyright holders in these cases are exploiting a loophole based on the pure bill of discovery, which allows them to demand subpoenas to internet providers without having to provide any evidence. There's your problem. For months, this cheap trick proved to be very effective, but not anymore. In the case of Moody's movie studio Boy Racer against 615 unnamed BitTorrent users, Judge Mark Schumacher has issued a landmark ruling. The judge starts off by describing the mass BitTorrent lawsuits as phishing expeditions and brands the copyright holders as trolls.
Wow.
What was going on. It's like they are abusing the system to shake people down.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, he found a way to shut it down. And he did. He said, you're violating their right to anonymous free speech. That's constitutional. Get the fuck out.
Finally, someone that's actually switched on.
Well, I'm kind of hoping as we get more and more people actually up and into the system who've, you know, grown up with this technology, or at least it's been around, or maybe they have kids who can explain it to them. It's like, you're not actually stealing anything, you're just copying it. So you might be depriving them of profits, or, you know, you might not be if you weren't going to buy it in the first place, because that whole argument, whereas in law it's kind of been settled that, you know, copying is theft, in as a practical matter, I don't think it has ever really been settled. I mean, you know, you ask the lawyers, yes, copying is theft, unless they're, if you ask the prosecutors, yes, copying is theft. If you ask the defendants, they're not so sure about it. But if you think about it, yes, Syntax?
What?
You're making noises in the microphone like you were wanting to talk there.
Oh, no. No, I was just listening.
So, if you think about it, I mean, if I make a copy of something from online, say, through BitTorrent, is the original holder missing anything? Arguably, the amount of money you should have paid to have that copy, but they didn't provide the copy. Somebody else did. So.
Well, copyright is horrible.
Yeah, the law's bad.
Yeah, digital copies of stuff going out. I don't know how many times that I have listen to copyrighted material on YouTube. I'm not going to say I downloaded anything.
Bullshit.
Shut up. But, you know, I've listened to less than legal copywritten material and have gone, this is really, really good, and then gone out and bought it. And I'm kind of a weirdo because I don't like download from iTunes or any of the other like legal download places because I like the liner notes. I like all that shit that comes with music when you buy it. That could be the DJ part in me going, you know, look, I have a vinyl album and look, there's liner notes and there's funny little tidbit stories that you don't get unless you actually go out and buy it. But there's a lot of music that I've listened to in a less than legal way and have gone, this is shit. I thought this was going to be good. It's not. So I don't go buy it.
I wonder if that's, you know, I kind of wonder if that's part of the reason why they go so nuts on this copyright stuff is because the number of people who have to buy it to see whether or not it's any good goes dramatically down because you can now preview it. And if it is good, you can go buy it. And if it's not any good, you don't, which means they lose out on X number of sales while people figure out something's crap.
Yeah. And
I mean, how many movie ticket sales do they get on that first night of a real stinker of a movie until the word gets out that the movie's crap, don't go see it?
Yeah.
And you know, that kind of goes away when people can preview stuff for free, and it's not the controlled preview, it's actually the full thing.
Yeah.
So
and music
that could be
go ahead.
Music, yeah, like I don't mean to plug anything, but there's only one way to say it. Groove Shark, man. If I'm not listening to the station, I'm on Groove. Because dude, there's everything there that you'd want. And it's easy to use. You don't have to. And it's all, according to you guys, legit.
I thought they were getting sued right now.
Oh, are they? Cool.
Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else. There's a couple of them, like Groove Shark.
Yeah, I use Groove Shark. You know, I think it's fine. And, yeah.
So. All right. Well, we kind of blew through those pretty quick. So let's go ahead and get into this.
Me love you long time.
All right, I thought, you know, we'd start off Digital Dojo tonight talking about something actually, it's pretty basic, but I'm sure a lot of people, at least who listen to this show, actually don't have a clue what it really is. They kind of hear it thrown about a bit, or, you know, they see people talking about it in, like, reference to Anonymous or whatever, but they don't really, you know, they don't actually have a good idea of what it is, and that's SQL injection. And it's a pretty common thing. It's more accurate to call it a code injection attack. And essentially what SQL injection is...
Well, isn't the whole reason why they called it SQL injection is because the SQL databases were the first ones to have the major flaw?
And it's still database is still pretty much what you're going after. It's finding a place in an application, generally a web application, that does not properly sanitize user input or anything the user provides and taking advantage of it. And, of course, the classic one is single tick parentheses space or space 1=1 semicolon. And you throw that in a password box, and the concept there is your general SQL statement is going to be something along the lines of, you know, select star from users where user equals whatever and password, and then do an if comparison on the password, right? So what that tells it is close out the original SQL statement and then say or when, you know, it's 1=1 because that turns the whole thing into a big or statement. And of course, 1=1. So it's going to come back true and it's going to let you in without the password. Now, I'm going to tell you straight up, most web applications do not fall for that one anymore. You'd be surprised the ones that still do, but that one's getting fixed.
It's been a long time since that's worked on anything major.
Right. Now, the really fun part is, though, One of the reasons a lot of that quits working a lot of places is not because they fixed the code. It's because they put something in front of the web server, usually a web application firewall or just an ID or an IPS of some sort, and it's watching for that specific string or 1=1. So you can switch it up a little bit and then get past these filters. So you say or 5=5 or 1=1, because those are also valid SQL statements and still factor out to true. And actually, if you know what server you're going after, a lot of them actually support a Boolean just straight up true. So you just say or true. So it's all in how creative you want to get. Now, most applications, the reason this works at all is because most web applications are written in a text-based scripting language. It's not pre-compiled. It's compiled at runtime. So you can actually jack extra code in there if you know where to put it, and get the web server to execute code that the people running the server never intended it to run. And as we were saying a minute ago, the most common use of this is to manipulate a database. It's where the SQL part of the name comes from. Generally, like one of the common things Anonymous is doing is they're popping into a web server and dumping out like a forum's users database, right? And the way they're doing that, well, it depends. But generally, you would do something like...
Did you just say that they're calling it depends like a diaper?
Nah, I think I may have blurred some words together. But
okay.
Generally what they're doing...
Just completely shut your brain down. I'm sorry.
Let's see. Right. So... generally, what they do is they break into a web server and then actually dump out the database through a shell. But you could, depending on the web application, get it to spit the thing out just in the page. Generally, when you're doing SQL injection, if you get classic SQL injection, like they don't check a form, you can get it to dump out, like, you know, select all from users and get it to dump it out right there in the page, and you just copy-paste it into something and you can start manipulating it and seeing what's going on the back end. You can get really crafty if you know what the database server is and get it to dump out the database structure so you can see what their forms are called, what their tables, their cells, all that good stuff. Figure out how their web application really works, and then take advantage of this to, say, create an administrator account so you can get into the back end of the database and start doing nastiness. This is pretty much how they're defacing websites these days. And the reason I say it's more accurate to call it code injection is because you don't have to inject SQL. You could close out the SQL statement and inject a bunch of PHP code. And in fact, a couple years back, there was a great attack on PHPMyAdmin, which is actually a database administration program, that you could inject PHP code. And I saw some bots that were running around injecting a remote text file, which instructed the server to write out a C source file into the web server directory and then execute it, or compile it, then execute it. And one of the reasons it didn't work against one of our servers was the server didn't actually have the C compile tools installed on it. They had been removed for space reasons. So that actually broke the script because it couldn't compile it, but it generally assumed that you would have access to GCC on any Linux server. So that kind of broke their script. But this is the most common way to deface and hack web pages these days, is to do this code injection and either get a shell on the server and or just, you know, straight up put crap in their database.
Nice.
So it's actually fairly simple. You do a little bit of you have to do some digging on the page to see if you can figure out what their database server is. Because I'll tell you straight up, if you throw Oracle code at a MySQL database, it doesn't work that well. You probably will get something out of it, but it's not very clean.
Why don't you just ring the company up and do a bit of social engineering and talk to the IT department?
Well, that's pretend to be sales. That's certainly another way to go about it.
Or go to the sales team and go, look, I'm from blah, blah, blah. I'm interested in selling you a new blah, blah, blah. What are you running currently?
Well, because that's certainly a good way to figure out what's going on. But you're also talking about a very targeted attack. I'm talking about a general attack methodology. You can. Okay. The fun thing about SQL injection is, just as an example, I said PHP my admin earlier, as one I've seen a code injection attack on. Generally, you can get a pretty good idea of every PHP my admin install out there by pulling it down yourself and seeing what it's running. You can see directory paths. You can see what database it's talking to. And if you find a good code injection in a commonly used project, you can actually automate it. So this is done by malware authors a lot, is they find common SQL injections, things that are easy to look for, easy to do, things in like old copies of Drupal or old copies of what's the other CMS? Joomla? Yeah, Joomla. Or the plugins, common plugins for things like WordPress and Joomla and Drupal, things that aren't as checked as tightly as the mainline code. And that's one of the reasons we run very plugin light on the Galaxy 15 page, is because if we start having too much in there, there's, you know, chance we'll get something in there that's got a hole in it, and then suddenly the whole website's vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
So I will say most of your modern web programming frameworks, you know, like Ruby on Rails and some of the Python frameworks and even jQuery to an extent, are getting very good at catching this. Like, they won't let you put together an app if you're using the modern frameworks that doesn't properly check user input or doesn't just do pre-construction on the SQL queries, so that it's taking values and using pre-constructed queries as opposed to just generating a query on the fly. But most people aren't using a modern framework, especially ones that have only been out for a year or two. They're still using fully custom PHP or ASP apps developed in-house. They haven't been tested that hard, and they're full of holes. JavaScript is commonly used to validate user input. So suddenly your copy of NoScript can be a hacker tool, because you keep their input validation from working before you send off the script. And this actually happens so often, it's not even funny, where they find the SQL injection like long after the fact, and either they fired or can't find, or, you know, nobody remembers who wrote the original tool. So they just have some web designer go in with a bit of JavaScript and have it check the input fields before passing stuff onto the server. But JavaScript runs client-side, so you can kind of manipulate it and use things like NoScript to prevent it from running at all and still put in nastiness and do horrible things to their website, right? And you can actually look... a lot of websites still pass variables in the URLs. You know, you'll see that question mark and then name of the variable equals and whatever it is. If you see variables being passed in the URL, that's a good place to do code injection, because it's straight up to the server. It's not going through any of their filtering on their page or anything on their JavaScript or any other filtering they're doing. It's going straight up to the script on the server. So you've really got to do your input validation server side on the receiving script. You can't trust that you're going to get clean input from a user's machine. So...
So what you're saying, I mean, it pretty much comes down to developers understanding what SQL injection is and protecting against it.
Oh, yeah. No, I was working with a couple of web developers at work a few months back, and I had to explain the concept. These are people who have been web developers for years. And, you know, the one guy asked me, well, why the hell would anybody put SQL code in a username box? It's like, because you can fuck with the database. Well, why would you want to do that?
Exactly.
Because they're bad guys. They do that shit. You know, when you have to get that, you have to take it down to that level sometimes of like, they're bad guys. You know, it's you pick some TV show and say, the bad guys from that. You know, they're the Borg. They're, I don't know, Klingons, whatever, right? That's all that's coming to mind right now. I'm sure somebody can think of a better analogy for me. But, yeah. So... Anyways, though, that's the general concept behind code injection, specifically SQL injection, is you find a place on the web application that doesn't properly sanitize your user input, and you pass it code and see if it'll execute. Sometimes it's kind of the same thing. When you see variables passed in URLs, you actually see this a lot on sites that are themed. They have a theme that's done up in PHP, And then the PHP, the common sign for this is everything links to the same page, and then question mark, and something like P equals, you know, page equals, and then they'll have a reference to another file, generally an HTML file or just a name. Well, sometimes you can put completely different URLs in there and get the server to yank in and execute code from like a different website. So you can actually do code injection that way just by referencing another URL and having, you know, nastiness wrapped up in a text file and get their server to pull it in and run it that way. It's almost hard to talk about this because there's so many ways to do it. It's hard to generalize, you know, without just saying something really vague, like, you know, anywhere you can put user input, because there's a lot of places on a web page you can, you know, induce it to run code.
How does anything work?
You know, it's a wonder. It's an absolute wonder that the internet works at all.
Yeah, I was just like, yeah. Wow.
Or you start thinking about it and realizes all the different places you can put crap in a page.
Yeah, I'm just sitting there going, oh, fuck, really? Yeah, no, I'm good.
Yeah, this is actually how they do it. Now, I've got a couple of tools here listed out for us.
So,
go ahead.
Now, we have the little feedback box on the G15 page.
Yes. I've tried to do some checking on that basic stuff, essentially throwing code at it to see if it'd take it. I've deleted all that out of there. I did not have too much of a problem with it, but I'm also not going to claim to have thrown everything at it, because I'm not going to claim to know all the different ways to do code injection, because there's a lot of them. But the shoutbox has generally been pretty good, and the IDS has done a really good job of picking up some stuff too. You can ask Tack about that. He actually got his own. He got himself banned for 10 minutes while working on the theme to the site. We had to turn the IDS off for about half an hour because he managed to trigger it while he was working on the themes. That thing is pretty paranoid. I mean, it's old man on the porch with the shotgun paranoid. I love it. It's like it even thinks you're doing something oddball, and it just doesn't even ask questions. It's just like, nope, ban.
Oh, hey, when we're off air, you need to let me know which one you're using.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can do that.
Because, yeah, there's things with the thing and the guy and a duck.
And a duck. Oh, I don't even want to know what you're doing with the duck. But,
well, there's ducks and kittens and, you know.
I'm not even going to go there. But anyways, back to code injection. I got a couple of tools listed out here that are handy for this. The first one is probably the go-to tool if you're doing SQL injection, and that's SQL Map. It's on sqlmap.sourceforge.net. It's a script. It is recently been rewritten, actually. SQL Map is an open-source penetration testing tool that automates the process of detecting and exploiting SQL injection flaws and taking over database servers. It comes with a powerful detection engine, many niche features for the ultimate penetration tester, and a broad range of switches lasting from database fingerprinting over data fetching from the database to accessing the underlying file system and executing commands on the operating system via out-of-band connections. I have played with SQL Map, and I really like it. The really fun part about it is if you find a good SQL injection, you can feed it into SQL Map, and the damn thing will give you an SQL prompt. And it's actually feeding all of those commands and pulling the responses out of that SQL injection hole in a web page. So you don't even need credentials. If you find a SQL injection, this thing will give you an SQL prompt. You can just browse through their database with it.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
That's nice. Cool. It's pretty. It's actually got a wizard mode. It's got the stupid mode, basically. You can go in and run stupid mode, and it just sits there and asks you questions. Like, what's the URL?
You mean script kiddie mode.
It's script kiddie mode. It's like, what's the URL? What's the database backend? Okay, here you go. I mean, it's just like, really? I mean, you know, with stuff like this out there, it's like, geez, no wonder Anonymous is so damned effective. And to be fair, generally when I'm testing for SQL injection, I'm not even bothering with SQL Map. I pull up an IDS and just have it watch the traffic going both ways. Just tell it everything's bad and, you know, throw it in hyper detection mode. And I have it pick out all kinds of crap doing that, just where it sees raw SQL connections going in the clear through the page. That means they're manipulable. Now, maybe not directly by messing with the URL or messing with you know, forms on the page, but something in there is triggering SQL statements. So that's when you get into controlled proxies. Now, this concept is a little bit odd. Essentially, you are running a proxy server on your own computer for your web connections. And at first, if you don't really know what's going on here, it might be kind of hard to understand why you would even want to bother with that. But the one I usually go to is WebScarab. And it is. It's a proxy server on your own computer. You run this program, and then you point your browser at, like, localhost, and then, oh, geez, I forget the port, 8837 or something like that. WebScarab is a framework for analyzing applications that communicate using HTTP and HTTPS protocols. It's written in Java and portable to many platforms. WebScarab has several modes of operation implemented by a number of plugins. In its most common usage, WebScarab operates as an intercepting proxy, allowing the operator to review and modify, there's your fun part, requests created by the browser before they are sent to the server, and then to review and modify responses returned from the server before they are received by the browser. WebScarab is able to intercept both HTTP and HTTPS communication. Now, you might think this would be something you would use for, like, a man-in-the-middle attack, which is kind of true, except you're man-in-the-middling yourself. The idea is the browser is not going to show you everything you need to, you know, see to manipulate stuff coming in and leaving a page, generally because that's not the tool of the browser. The job of the browser is to, you know, as quickly as possible, pull stuff down and display it to you. So what WebScarab does is it, when you run it and request a page, WebScarab actually intercepts and holds the request. You open up WebScarab, you find the request in the tab, and you can review everything about the request. You know, what's in the packets, what kind of, you know, are you making a post or a get, what's in all the variables that are being sent off, and it can break it all down for you. If you've got a page that's doing, like, SOAP or XML communication, it'll catch all of those, and you can actually, you know, screw with things that are being sent out by scripting on the page. If you've got an AJAX page that's making constant requests, this will catch them. Now, when you first start playing with it, you might be tempted to hit up some of the web applications, some of the really heavy ones, and it's like they break. And what's happening is they're timing out because you're not flipping over to the proxy fast enough to send the requests. But if you're trying to hunt through a form and you really want to see if there's something you can screw with, I mean, this is the ultimate in catching something once it leaves the browser, is these kind of proxies. WebScarab isn't the only one, but it's generally my favorite. Go ahead, Sard.
I was just going to say, that's really cool. I've never heard of that before. And it kind of leads back to, you know, sysadmins needing to watch your servers and actually looking at logs and seeing what URLs people are going to and seeing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I guess that's a little impractical on some very, very busy web servers. But, I mean, there's got to be tools out there that
it's not nearly as weird as you would think. There's plenty of tools out there for watching log files for common things. And a very easy one is something along the lines of, why is my web server trying to make direct requests to our internal database server or our Active Directory servers, and it's making requests on ports that web server should never make requests on? Kind of thing.
Or, like, saying, is it making a request to the local hard drive outside of the web directory or something like that?
Sure. I mean, you kind of have to know what the web server's supposed to do. You know, it'd be kind of silly to say, well, I'm going to flag every database connection if your website's database driven. But you might say, why is my web server connecting to that database over there that it should never, ever talk to? Or why is my web server executing code from a Dropbox folder? That probably shouldn't be happening. You know, that's
fine. Don't worry about it.
Well, that's what the attacker wants, is they're hoping nobody's reviewing the logs and watching for those kind of things. Because Apache, I'm pretty sure IIS does it too, but I've never actually turned it on ISS because I don't use it very much if I can help it. But Apache, you can actually have it log every single web request, and there's plenty of tools out there for going through those files, and you can actually write. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there's a couple of different tools out there that'll actually let you write IDS-style rules for your log files. And so it's like, you know, if this thing ever makes a request to our internal file server, you know, page a few people and set off a siren. That means the web server's been hacked.
Kill so, shit.
Yeah. Oh,
dude, that's when you shut your fucking mouth and try and do your job. Wait, well, you don't get fired.
Yeah.
Do you know off the top of your head more, if suddenly you can't, couldn't think of the name of them, but do they work with any log file, or are we just talking web
There's logs? A couple of different ones out there. Well, of course, there's always Splunk. I don't know that Splunk does the whole rule-based alerting thing. I'm thinking mostly of SIMs that actually do that kind of thing, where you point your log files at them over like a syslog, and it can watch the log files for oddball things. So Alien Vault, okay. I think, is the one I was thinking of. And yeah, it'll take anything you can. You might have to go in and write a interpreter for it. You know, tell it how to process that log file. But if it's a common project, it's probably already got one.
That's cool. Yeah, could definitely use. I'm thinking about a different protocol and different log files that I might be able to use that for.
Yeah, I've got it. I can't remember that tool off the top of my head. It's driving me nuts because there was one I was playing with earlier. Were you going to say something, are you?
No, sir.
Okay. The last tool I've got in the list is actually the Burp Suite. Now, this one's on, I got a link in the show notes, of course. Burp Suite is an integrated platform for performing security testing of web applications. Its various tools work seamlessly together to support the entire testing process, from initial mapping and analysis of web applications' attack surface to finding and exploiting security vulnerabilities. Now, Burp Suite is an entire penetration testing toolkit for web applications, but it's got the same proxy functionality as Web Scarab. And it's got a web spidering aspect. So if you wanted to tell it to go crawl a site and find every place that could potentially be a code injection, and then even have it do some rudimentary testing for it, Burp Suite will do that for you. Now, I've not used Burp Suite very much because it has a free and then a pro version. And the last time I played with it, the free version was kind of, it felt crippled. Now, I didn't get that far with it, admittedly, because I was used to Web Scarab and I was just like, eh, whatever, and you know, went back to Web Scarab. But, you know, I will admit I've not played with Burp very much, but I know a lot of professional pen testers, that's like the go-to tool. So I would not throw that one out, and I'd be silly of me not to mention that it exists. So.
Cool.
I think I've covered pretty much everything, at least on the basics on that. So, I don't know. Syntax, you think I missed anything on code injection there?
No, everything actually sounded really good. Okay.
There's a lot to it, and I'm just trying to make sure I hit the basics.
There really is. I'm like, there's all these other different things, but it's getting far too in-depth for
show. It's really hard to do an audio.
Yeah, it is. It's like, okay, see what I'm doing here.
Yeah. Actually,
on the radio.
In the show notes, I'm going to have some links to on unixwiz.net. They have, it's kind of an old guide to SQL injection, but they've got a bunch of examples of SQL injection on unixwiz.net. And on the pentestmonkey.net site, they've actually got a SQL injection cheat sheet for MySQL and MSSQL, actually, now that I think about it. But they've got a couple of different cheat sheets on the Pentest Monkey site. And so you can see some examples of the kind of strings you would throw into an input box or into a URL to get the web page to do things that it, you know, isn't supposed to do and induce it to run your code instead of their code or in addition to their code. The whole idea.
And a word to all the young kids who are starting out. Either, you know, white or black or gray, whatever hat you have on, learn what what we had to go through 15, 20 years ago, because you might see things. So, you know, saying that it's an old guide is I think is good for the young kid or the younger people out there, because it gives you a good base.
Well, I just, you know, I just had an epiphany right now as we're doing the show. Iron Geek has a web application testing target, so to speak, that you can download and run a virtual machine called Matilidae. And he's actually got a series of tutorials on his site. Now, granted, it's for all kinds of different web application attacks, but he does a bunch of SQL injection through this tool. So as opposed to going out and say, I'm going to hack Yahoo, or I'm going to go after Google, you know, and get yourself in trouble, pull down Matilidae, throw it in a virtual machine, like, say, VirtualBox, and I'm going to add the link to the Digital Dojo show notes right now. But go pull down Matilidae, and now you've got something to try some of these attacks against without, you know, getting carted off to, you know, ram me in the ass federal prison. Unless, of course, you're into that. But,
yeah, but that's saying if you're actually following along this conversation and you don't go to Iron Geek once a month, at least once a month, and check out the new stuff, then you're just not doing it right.
Well, you know, Adrian does an awesome job of cataloging a lot of the HackerCon videos, and that's one of the best ways of staying up to date with what's going on is to sit down and watch a lot of those videos.
I love those videos, man.
So, but yeah, he's got a great set of tutorials on his Matilidae web application testing target. I'm trying to. It's an intentionally vulnerable web application. I'm trying to think of how to say. OWASP has one as well, but I like Matilidae better. So, something to practice on, something to think about. I'm trying to make sure I've hit everything.
And I'll give you feedback if you haven't.
Yeah. Use the feedback forms. Go on galaxy15radio.com. There's a feedback form. Let me know, especially if there's an area you really wanted us to focus on in Digital Dojo. I'm always looking for ideas of things to really hit, because I'm not actually sure. Because I would love to go into the finer points of, you know, this meterpreter module, or how to really get in depth on some of these things and really hit them hard. But on the other hand, I'm afraid I'm going to get into stuff. Everybody else is going to be like, yeah, boring. Shut the hell up. So, you know, I don't know what people want to hear. So,
dude, this show's been running long enough now. If they come along and say, this is boring, piss off.
Well, I'm into the finer minutiae of some command line switches on Nmap, I wouldn't blame you for calling it boring. So, but anyways, yeah. So, of course, listen to the stream. We're constantly updating it. Sard's always been looking for new music. Although, I think RU and I are going to have a little conversation with Sard about some of the music he's been putting on the stream here lately.
I'm going to take him aside and, you know, show him that he may not be fully operational when it comes to some music.
Of course, I have nothing every... Oh. I have nothing... We're taking a couple of weeks break on...
2 weeks break on the I Have Nothing show. Come on, give us a break, guys. 150 episodes. We've only ever had, a month off, I think, all up.
Something like that. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday between the sheets on Fridays in R7. Whenever somebody can find BSV, last we heard he was hiding in a bunker somewhere saying something about the tables were going to eat him. And we've already covered the Galaxy 15 radio site and the Twitter handles. Use the feedback form. Tell us what you want to hear. Or just make fun of us. I don't really care. If I've made a mistake somewhere, don't just tell me I'm wrong. Shoot me a link so that I can read up on it. I would really appreciate it. And I think
you're wrong.
Yeah, that's handy. So, you know, tell me why I'm wrong so that I can fix it. If I'm saying something, it's because I think that's the correct answer. And if it's not the correct answer, I want to know that so I can fix it. Can't fix it if you don't know it's broken. You know what I mean?
And If anyone has any questions or feedback, or it's more questions and show topic stuff for Between the Sheets, let us know. I know you have more listeners than I do, so I'm pimping my show on your show.
How is baby made?
You know, we were actually thinking about doing a live, basically
a webcam demonstration.
Exactly, a live demonstration on how babies made.
I think we need to register a new URL if we're going to be doing that one. We'll end in XXX, I think. So that's pretty much all I've got. Has anybody else got anything else besides Syntax pimping his show? We've got all the major hosts on tonight, so
yeah, I've got nothing.
Nope,
me either.
All right, well that's pretty much it for tonight then, guys. See you on the week.
Good night.
yours and mine.